back with you with our very, very special guest, Dr. Michael E. Sala, who is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. Now, I know many of you have never heard that term before, but it's very important for us all to understand that term. Dr. Sala, welcome to We Ourselves.
Aloha, Ambrose. Thanks for having me on the show.
Now, is it my understanding that you're in Hawaii and it's 5 a.m. there?
Sure is, Ambrose. Nice and early, so a beautiful day ahead of us, though.
Okay. We want to thank you for making that sacrifice for us. Why don't we start by having you to explain what is exopolitics, exopolitics?
Well, basically, the simplest way of describing exopolitics, it's like exobiology. Exobiology, most people understand, is all about the biological study of extraterrestrial life. And that is something that people often encounter. And so, in terms of the news and some mainstream researchers who discuss the possibility of biological life on Mars or on the Moon or wherever it is in the solar system or elsewhere, exopolitics is similar. It's basically looking at the political implications of extraterrestrial life. So it's not just, well, if extraterrestrials are out there, well, you know, what's their biology like? Exopolitics is looking at, well, what are the political implications of this? What does it mean for our political institutions, our economic structures, our technologies, our scientific base, religion, and so forth? So really, those are the sorts of issues that exopolitics focuses on.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to get an interest in exopolitics?
Well, my background is in political science. I was teaching at American University. I was there for 8 years in D.C. itself, so I understand that's not too far from where you're located.
Right.
And I became interested towards the end of my appointment there in this information that was very credible that was being put out by a number of whistleblowers that they had worked on various projects or they had seen evidence that there was extraterrestrial life visiting the planet and that this was being repressed by various government agencies. And so I became very interested in that because it brought in a kind of entirely new dimension into the study of international politics. And so I've since been doing a lot of research, interviewing whistleblowers myself, going to some of the documents that are available, and basically found that you know, this is very credible, that indeed the evidence bears out that we are being visited by extraterrestrial civilizations and our governments are covering it up.
And this has been going on at least since the Eisenhower administration, right?
Well, that's right, yes. So the Eisenhower administration is a very important one because that, as far as I can tell, was the first time there were actual agreements reached with these extraterrestrial visitors. And that must be mind-blowing for a lot of people to hear that.
Absolutely.
But this is exactly what I believe has happened based on the evidence that I've gone over, a number of whistleblowers who have come forward, talked about their various roles in what had happened. For example, I have spoken to a whistleblower, a very old gentleman, who actually was at a military base in 1955, Holloman Air Force Base. He was working as a medic at the time. And he says that he was on duty when Eisenhower flew in on Air Force One, met with extraterrestrial visitors who flew in their own ships. All the military personnel who witnessed this were taken into a hangar and basically debriefed and sworn to secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
And virtually everyone at that base has not divulged what happened apart from this one medic who has come forward. And he only did this recently, so this is the level of secrecy that has been operating in this field.
Mm-hmm. Now, you cite as evidence that there might be as many as 17 different extraterrestrial civilizations currently interacting with humanity. Is that related in any way to the agreement that Eisenhower made with them?
Well, It's partly as a result of that agreement. Eisenhower met with extraterrestrials who were very concerned about the nuclear proliferation that was happening back in the 50s that under Eisenhower, the hydrogen bomb test was going forward. And it seems that extraterrestrial visitors were very concerned about this, and I believe it's because the detonation of thermonuclear weapons especially disrupts the time-space continuum in ways that is harmful to the trade routes used by these extraterrestrial visitors. It's like blowing a bomb in a kind of I-95.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, traffic is halted and long detours, and it disrupts trade. And it seems that this was what was happening with nuclear weapons. And so it appears that a number of different extraterrestrial civilizations came and had a look at, you know, well, who are these kind of people? Who's this civilization disrupting our trade routes? And I think that's where we had so much interest by these different races.
Yeah, the testing of nuclear weapons, especially out west, became a real problem. And apparently there was an agreement to make all the tests subsequent underground tests.
That's right, Ambrose. Up until the 1960s, they were conducting a large number of above-ground tests. They were even conducting high atmospheric tests. They were detonating nuclear weapons in space,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they were doing. They were trying to see what the effects of this would be. And I think one of the things that people don't realize is that a lot of the UFO crashes can be directly related to these high-level atmospheric tests. In other words, they were finding that UFOs would crash after they would perform some of these tests, kind of like the way in which people can go fishing by detonating explosives in a river, and it just stuns all the fish, and you just go pick them up. Well, it seems that this is what was happening, that the military would detonate these nuclear weapons up in the atmosphere, and these UFOs would just suddenly start crashing down because the time-space continuum was disrupted by these massive electromagnetic pulses being generated by these nuclear detonations. But in the 1960s, it appears that all came to an end and only underground tests were tolerated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The very existence of extraterrestrials is something that the American people have shied away from dealing with, except for a few people who have taken it on as an important aspect of life that we ought to be concerned about.
Well, that's right. Essentially, there's always been a high-level interest. I mean, there's always been a lot of people interested in UFOs and extraterrestrial visitors. I mean, you can go right back to the early 50s where all those movies came out about extraterrestrial visitors, and that continues today. But what has happened is that anyone studying this has been ridiculed. In other words, there's been a lot of ridicule attached to this field. So it really meant that anyone who got interested in this, if you were a professional working in academia or in the media or in any political institution or representing government at any level, if you were a professional at any level and you got interested in this, you would be ridiculed to the extent that your career would be threatened. And that was a major deterrent for a lot of people, because I think people can be interested in something, but if your interest suddenly leads to you being ridiculed by your peers, means that only very few will actually run the risk. And I have found that this even continues to today. I did find, for example, in speaking to many of my colleagues at American University when I was teaching and I got interested in this field, that people would say, yes, I'm interested in this, but they would say, I don't want to be associated with it. I don't want you to use my name.
Right. Because they would be embarrassed by folks who don't want this information out. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, what I'd like for you to do is to tell our listeners the story of Nikola Tesla and Otis Carr and Ralph Ring. Fascinating story. We'll be right back. And we're back. And our special guest is none other than Dr. Michael Sala, who is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. Would you share with our listeners the story of Tesla and Carr?
Well, that's a fascinating story, Ambrose. Basically, yeah. What that involves is an inventor by the name of Otis Carr, who in the late 1950s was developing a spacecraft that he claimed would be able to go to the moon, and he was saying that he was using ideas that he had been told by Nikola Tesla, the famous inventor from Serbia. And so basically Otis Carr, he developed this spacecraft in firstly in Oklahoma, and then he moved to California. And as far as history knows, he failed, and he essentially was charged with defrauding investors with his wild scheme of developing a spacecraft that could go to the moon and could revolutionize the aviation industry. And so basically little was known of him after he was released from prison in the 1960s and for fraud. And so he died in obscurity. And that's pretty much the way in which people understood Otis Carr, that he was someone who had defrauded people because he made these claims of building a spacecraft. Well, what happened was last year, a gentleman emerged from basically just came out of nowhere, Ralph Ring, who said that he worked with Otis Carr, and in fact it's been confirmed that he did work with Otis Carr, and he said that rather than having failed, Otis Carr had succeeded. And so what happened is...
In fact, he was one of the pilots, wasn't he?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
He was one of the pilots.
That's right, yes. Ralph Ring was one of the pilots of a craft that had been successfully tested, a 45-foot teleportation spacecraft that was tested with Ralph Ring as one of the three pilots. And Ralph Ring came forward to describe what happened with the test, how the test involved the use of these advanced technologies and navigation equipment that Otis Carr had developed, how the pilots use their thoughts to control the navigation of the craft, which is quite unique, and how it traveled instantaneously. It just the initial test run was a 10-mile trip down to another location nearby, and it was done instantaneously and then came back, and there was a kind of shift in time as well. So for Ralph Ring, it appeared that only 30 seconds had gone by, when in fact it had been a few, like 5 minutes or more that had actually elapsed during the first test. And what happened afterwards was really the key here for this particular case, and how it hasn't been known, is that 2 weeks after the successful test, and they were now preparing to do more ambitious tests, launching into space and eventually doing a moon shot, and this would have all been using this civilian spacecraft that would have been mass-produced, is that they were raided by the FBI and other government agencies. 7 truckloads of agents pulled up to the manufacturing complex where they were building these prototypes. They basically confiscated all of the material, arrested everyone, debriefed everyone, telling them that they couldn't talk about what had happened, what they had seen. They could never talk to one another again. That they were a threat to the U.S. monetary system. That was what was told, that their development of this technology threatened the monetary system of the United States. And of course, Otis Carr soon afterwards was indicted and charged and basically put in prison for a number of years for fraud. And so what this shows is that, in fact, the extent to which various government agencies, in collusion with major oil interests and energy interests, will suppress any inventor coming forward with new energies or alternative technologies.
Why was it a threat? What powered these vehicles?
But basically, used power from the atmosphere. It would draw electricity from the atmosphere. This was based on some of the principles of Nikola Tesla, and you probably heard of zero-point energy.
Mm-hmm.
This was based on those principles, that you can draw electricity from the atmosphere, that Tesla believed that electricity is all around us. We don't need to have these centralized power production plants using oil and coal generating massive amounts of electricity that then get kind of routed along these electric wires into people's houses, that in fact electricity is in the very atmosphere. It's actually in the earth itself, and all you need to do is just put a particular device in the ground and it will start to generate electricity. And so this was the principle that was used for powering the spacecraft that Otis Carr developed. And it was a threat to the monetary system, because the US economy, as I'm sure you and your listeners are well aware, is very largely based on the control of many corporations over the energy sector, the energy interest. They've got massive investments in the energy sector. So if all of a sudden the oil industry, the coal industry were made redundant by these new energy technologies, that would actually be a great shock to the U.S. Economy, and also the monetary system. Like the U.S. dollar would lose a lot of value.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Conley in Texas. Conley, you're on Dr. Sorry.
Miss Lane, your show is wonderful today. Outstanding.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment, I'm a teacher now in Fort Worth, but the last 4 or 5 weeks of Ronald Reagan's presidency, George Bush, then the VP of the United States, and Reagan were giving a speech about Rice University, which is in Houston, called the Harvard of the South, was opening a new science wing, and they were helping raise private money.
Mm-hmm.
George Bush gave a very vanilla speech for about 3 or 4 minutes, and Ronald Reagan was not as close as me. But as George Bush sat down, Ronald Reagan walked up to the microphone and started talking about Star Wars. Why do you think I named it Star Wars? If any of y'all are really afraid of China or Russia, y'all are deeply mistaken. If y'all need to be afraid of somebody, be very afraid. And he points to the sky and says, I know of at least over a dozen real aliens that live here in the United States. And the Secret Service pulled him off the stage.
Mm.
Doctor, you may have heard something about that. Right at the end of Reagan's term, he was several times cut off from talking about aliens.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you know something about that.
Dr. Sala?
Yes, thank you, Connolly. Thanks for raising that. That's a very important point there, because Ronald Reagan actually made a number of speeches about the need for the governments of the world to band together to fight an extraterrestrial threat. And he said this a number of times in speeches with Secretary General Gorbachev of the Soviet Union, and he also said it at a major speech at the United Nations in New York. And what Connolly described of the Secret Service pulling him down from the podium is pretty much what often happened at these speeches. In other words, there were people around Reagan who were instructed to make sure that he would not talk about what he knew. Reagan was governor of California, and during that time, as governor, he came across some evidence of extraterrestrial civilizations. And when he was president of the United States, he was briefed to a certain extent about extraterrestrial visitors. And there's a very famous incident where Steven Spielberg went to the White House and showed his Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And after the showing, Reagan pulled Spielberg aside and said to him quietly, only half a dozen people in the room know how true that movie is. And that's one of the stories that that Reagan was briefed on the extraterrestrial visitors, and so he was someone that did know to a certain extent what was going on.
Okay, Connelly, thank you so much.
Thank you. Keep up the good work, Mr. Ambrose.
All right. And we'll be right back, and we'll take your calls at 866-801-8255. In your discussion, you cite the words of Senator Daniel Inouye, who said, "There exists a shadowy government with its own Air Force, its own Navy, its own fundraising mechanism, and the ability to pursue its own ideas of the national interest, free from all checks and balances, and free from the law itself." Would you explain what that means in this context?
Well, that's a very important statement by Senator Inouye.
Yes.
In 1960, well, actually, January 1961, President Eisenhower gave a very famous speech, his farewell speech, where he talked about the dangers presented by the military-industrial complex,
right,
where he referred to the power that had been welded in the hands of these various corporations and military associations. And what he was saying between the lines was that there had developed a rival to executive authority. In other words, the President of the United States did not have control over certain elements in the United States political system that was based in these military-industrial interests. And this was especially the case when it came to dealing with extraterrestrial technologies, because, as I said, this is information that is kept secret. And one of the things that has emerged over the 60 years of the secrecy is that the real power in what is being decided here lies in these secretly appointed committees outside of executive control, outside of the control of the President and of the U.S. Congress. And so what that means is that over 60 years we've had the evolution of a rival system, a rival military, a rival political system that is surrounded or that has deals with this extraterrestrial phenomenon. And Senator Inouye's comments allude to that, that in fact that this system is known by senior government officials who, like Eisenhower, are powerless to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Frank in Virginia. Frank, you're on.
Hi. I'd like to ask Dr. Sala if he thinks that this alternative, almost free energy can help with global warming, and how many people, if so, how many people know about it, and why aren't they telling us about it?
Hi, Frank. Good to hear you. The free energy and the global warming, very important issues. Free energy is one of those things that has a long history of being suppressed. We talked a little bit about Nikola Tesla, or mentioned him. He was one of the first people, actually the first major inventor, who actually came up with devices for free energy, the energy that could be drawn from the vacuum and from the atmosphere rather than having to have to be generated using fossil fuels. And of course we know that the consumption of fossil fuels has generated enormous pollutants that have really caused great havoc with the atmosphere, and we know global warming is very real. We know the polar ice caps are melting and that there's all sorts of possibilities of long-term flooding of coastal areas and many other dangers as well, ozone layer depletion and so forth. And so we really need to look at new energy alternatives, and so this is where the free energy initiatives that are proposed by people working in Washington D.C. area. I know, for example, Dr. Thomas Malone from the Integrity Research Institute. He's been working on free energy for some time, and he has a lot of information to share. And he actually will be coming to a conference we're hosting here in Hawaii next month, Ambrose. It's from May 11 to 13,
mm-hmm.
and it's titled Earth Transformation, New Science and Technologies, and Exopolitics. And what we're going to be looking at is the way in which these issues all come together, new science, new technologies, exopolitics, how they all combine, because they're all related.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks a lot, Frank.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Jonathan in Texas. Jonathan, you're on.
Hey, all this is pretty fringe to me. But if people can believe that woman was created from a man's rib, hey, anything's possible. Now, I have a question about one of the heavy hitters at NASA, and that was Carl Sagan. Some people know about his book, Ellie, but others probably know the movie that was based on that book, Contact. And he alluded to some of these things. Do you feel that Carl Sagan was in on this cover-up?
I think he was in on the cover-up. I think he was briefed. I think he was essentially one of the people in the scientific community who, because of his prestige and his knowledge, was taken in and consulted on some of these topics. Because, I mean, if you have a system that's running without the general public being aware of it, occasionally you need to have input from some of the brightest minds out there. And so what you need to do is you need to have them come and you need to classify the information, give them a security clearance, and get their input on things. And Sagan, I believe, was one of those people who was briefing the committees dealing with all of this technology that has been gained from extraterrestrial visitors. And so I think Carl Sagan was one of those that was briefed, and I think he never actually ever said anything directly saying that extraterrestrials are here visiting us, but he was always a big supporter of SETI, the Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and of course he wrote the book Contact, and so what he was doing there was basically acknowledging that there's something to all this, but he wasn't coming right out and saying, yes, this is real, you know, extraterrestrials are here visiting us. He was doing it in a roundabout way, so that way he could maintain that kind of double identity.
Okay.
Thanks, Jonathan. Let's go now to Jay in Tennessee. Jay, you're on.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
Good.
Good afternoon, actually. I was going to ask your guest about Mr. William Cooper, who wrote a book basically dealing with some of the subjects you're talking about. Secret government, UFOs and all that. It's my understanding Mr. Cooper is not with us anymore, and if this is true, I wanted to ask your guest, do you think it's bullshit, anything that is to do with it, is not being with us anymore, and I think my question out there.
Dr. Sala?
Thank you, Jay. Yes, William Cooper, he was the author of Beyond the Pale Horse, Behold a Pale Horse.
Yeah.
And he worked for the U.S. Navy in the 60s and 70s, and in the early 1970s, for a period of 3 years, I believe it was, he was on the briefing team for the commander of the Pacific Fleet. And during that time, he says he came across highly classified documents, compartmentalized documents dealing with the UFOs and the extraterrestrial presence, and that's where he learned about a lot of this information about the secret meetings between Eisenhower and extraterrestrials, how the government had reached agreements, how there had been a number of UFOs that had been shot down, how the technology had been reverse engineered, how this had been covered up and a system had been put in place to keep it secret from the American public for several decades. So he came forward, and he was one of the very first whistleblowers who came out and said what had happened. And he did take a tremendous risk. I mean, he was very severely criticized and attacked in many public fora. But the fact is that he did indeed work for the U.S. Navy. He was in the briefing team for the commander of the Pacific Fleet. So he did have the possible access that he claimed to have had. And I think in that sense, he was very credible. And his information is something we all need to take note of.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take your calls at 866-801-8255. We'll be right back. And we're back with you. We're going to try and get all of your calls in. Let's start first with Frank in North Carolina. Frank, you're on.
Yes. Amber, I wanted to ask your guest about, I read something somewhere a long time ago about Nikola Tesla was building a tower with a static type of generator on it that it would be able to generate power from the Earth rotation. And he was planning to donate free power to everybody, to citizens of the United States, and he was Polish, and they just cut off all funding for him, and in some way or another they tried to shame him. Could he speak on that?
Thanks so much, Frank.
Yes, Frank, that's true. Tesla actually built a number of towers. There was one in Colorado, there was one in Long Island, and he actually built two in Canada. People don't know about the two in Canada, but he also built those. It's the one in Long Island that was the famous one where basically J.P. Morgan had cut off funding and that Tesla couldn't proceed with his plans to develop wireless energy. In other words, he believed that we could actually have energy transferred wirelessly through this wireless means through these big towers. They would go to anywhere that was needed. And so this was one of the things that Tesla hoped he could build to really replace the very cumbersome electrical grid that we now have. Back in the early 1900s, but of course, the story goes that he was not able to go ahead because they couldn't put meters on this wireless transmission of energy.
And therefore charge people and make money.
That's right.
In fact, he was the one that taught Otis Carr, isn't he?
That's correct, yes. He met Otis Carr back around 1937, and for three years Otis Carr was a protege of Nikola Tesla, and Tesla basically told Carr everything he had to share on these ideas, because by that time Tesla was very frustrated. He wasn't getting any support, any funding for his many inventions, and so he thought he needed to hand this information down to someone who was receptive, and Otis Carr was one of those people.
Okay, let's go to Demetrius in Wisconsin. Demetrius, you're on.
Yes, how you doing, Brother Ambrose?
Good.
Yes, okay. You know, this is one of my most, I love this subject matter. ever since I got out of the Navy, I'll be honest, brother, I had went to a college to take up electronic engineering. I was hoping to give me a Nobel Prize in developing, you know, flying saucer drive, I guess you could say. But what happened, I discovered when I was taking up astronomy, sitting looking at the moon over 2 or 3 hours, something fly up and fly over and land. Right then, that set me off into a deep research to find out what's going on, because if I know I saw it, I know our government could have seen it. And I discovered a lot of things what our guest has been speaking on and about the free energy. But I want to go to this. There's a movie that came out called The Arrival and Arrival 2. And everything that we hear about global warming, if you look at the movie Arrival 2, it just came on a Cinemax or something like that this past week, or you can, you know, get the video. It came out in 1998, this movie. And everything that Gore said on his video, movie about global warming, you will hear it spoken of on this movie. And this happened 10 years ago, you know, and they were speaking about these aliens terraforming this earth, and they purposely trying to increase the temperature of this globe. And which is it's real strange, because last week I heard that the military is getting involved in the global warming process, and that made me wonder what was going on with that. And I've seen the movie again, and that this past week, couple of days ago, and that, you know, all I can say is I wish the guests and you and several of the listeners look at that movie. You'd be surprised.
What's the name of it again?
The Arrival.
Okay.
Arrival. Yes. Okay.
Okay. Dr. Sala?
Yes, well, there's many theories for what the extraterrestrials are doing here. I mean, the theories range from they're here to help us evolve and deal with our problems and make sure that we don't annihilate ourselves with nuclear weapons, to them wanting to use us as a biological resource in terms of abductions and taking various bodily fluids from people that are abducted, and also the theory that they want to replace the Earth with their own hybrids or their own beings. And so that's where maybe this idea of terraforming happening by stealth for extraterrestrials who will replace humanity comes from. I mean, that was the movie. It was a very interesting movie. I think at this stage there wouldn't be enough kind of data to say that that is in fact what the extraterrestrials are doing here.
Right.
I think they're doing other things, but certainly it was an interesting movie, and global warming is real.
Let's go to Charles in Virginia. Charles, you're on.
Oh, yes. Good afternoon, Brother Ambrose.
Good.
Yes. Just one quick question. Along with the idiom, there is nothing new on Earth. Artifacts discovered in Kemet, commonly known as Egypt today, there were aerodynamically designed models, such as aircraft or what have you, that were discovered in various areas of Kemet, as I say, commonly known as Egypt today. I'm just wondering, and also along with that, I understand in the schools that we call the mystery schools back then, there was some work being done in free energy in these mystery schools of Kemet. Does your guest have any response to that? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Charles.
Thanks, Charles, for the question. Now, I'm not sure if I got it right, but it seems that you wanted to know about the mystery schools in ancient Egypt and the Temple of Abydos with the depictions of the different technology. Yes, well, it certainly seems that the ancient Egyptians had very advanced technology, and where they got that from is very interesting. But of course, the question we all have to face is, well, where did they place that technology? If they did have these advanced technologies,
mm-hmm.
where are they now? I mean, are they buried in secret locations in Egypt? And there are all sorts of stories about hidden caverns and locations underneath the pyramids and the Sphinx with this buried technology. But certainly the Temple of Abydos and those pictures show that there was advanced technology that was available. And maybe part of the mystery school tradition was the development of skills to be able to use these technologies, because I think this is something that goes beyond Egypt. You can find elements of this in Peru, in India, in Tibet, that the technologies that were very advanced required certain mental abilities that were beyond the normal person, that so people had to be trained, and so those that actually did the training would be able to use these technologies, and from that would come great power and authority. So maybe that is part of the tradition behind the mystery schools, but of course we know very little of that now.
Yeah. Would you like to give out your email address so that the folks can get...
Sure, yes. Well, anyone can send me an email. My email is exopolitics, that's E-X-O, politics, P-O-L-I-T-I-C, at yahoo.com, or just visit my website, www.exopolitics.org.
All right. Let's go to Jimmy in Virginia.
Yeah,
quickly, because we've got a minute.
Okay. Yeah, hi, Mr. Ambrose.
Good.
I have a question for your guest. I detect a contradiction in his theory. The contradiction is of the visitors visiting because of their concerns of our nuclear proliferation, and yet he goes on and says that how they lend us technology that would... is capable of taking electricity from the air and utilizing it. I find that to be a contradiction.
Well, thanks for raising that question, Jenny. Maybe I need to clarify a little bit there. I mean, there are different extraterrestrial groups, and one of the groups was very interested in preventing the development of nuclear weapons. That was one of the things that they approached the Eisenhower administration about, to put a stop to that. And other groups of extraterrestrials are more interested in helping humanity develop alternative energy so that they can really help deal with environmental problems in a sustainable way. And so we do have different extraterrestrial groups here with different activities.
Dr. Sala, thank you so much for being with us. We're going to have you back because there's tremendous interest in this whole area.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Ambrose, and I'd love to come back another time.
Okay, take care now.
Right.
We're going to check out, and we'll be right back, and we'll take the calls at 866-801-8255. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the Virginia Tech and bring you up to date.